Okay, so this week we're going to try something a little bit new. I had a really good conversation that was kind of wide ranging with John Pang and Jess, and it went on for a long time. I think it was like 3 hours plus. Sometimes, like we don't really have the greatest time discipline or whatever. And so I think what I'm going to try to do this week is just extract about an hour plus from that as a pod, which I think is kind of like maybe sort of like the meat and bones of the discussion, and put that out just as its own pod. And for the Patreon, we'll release the sort of full conversation if you want to hear all of it, if you want to support us and get access to our bonus pods and access to the Discord, etc. Go to patreon.com/planamag, and here's the pod for this week.
Here's my grand theory about what's going on right now in terms of this like slide backwards, right?
Yes, let's hear it.
Okay. I do think that we are on a cultural regression. I think more than enough people have come out and said the same thing. Everyone agrees we're not producing new culture, right? We are constantly looking backwards. We're not looking forward. We are constantly moving backwards in cultural time and reviving previous periods and trying to bring them into the present. And I think that's part of a psychological desire. It's a psychological acknowledgement at a mass scale that something went wrong. And our job is to go back in time, figure out at what point we made the wrong decision and correct it. Right. And there's a political aspect to this, which is that, like you said, like you were pointing at, Jess, which I agree with, is that different factions, I don't think it's just liberals and conservatives, but different. That's one way of cutting it. There's many other factions, but whatever factions
I
exist
agree.
Are in a political struggle in the cultural level to push a particular era in our history as the moment where everything was right until we made a wrong decision at that time, right? And so I think that in this backwards looking thing, it's like we're re-raising the stakes every time. And I think there was a time when we thought, man, weren't the 80s great? And you saw this huge wave of nostalgia for the 80s and stuff like that. And 80s was a good time for us, the United States. We had purpose. We were in the Cold War, but that really, the search continued. I don't think that there was full consensus that that was it. There was a lot of problems with the 1980s. Okay. So we went back and back. And then was it last year when suddenly we had this double bill of Barbie and Oppenheimer, and I'm like, this is this 1950s pastiche just took over the landscape, and you still see it, like this obsession with the 1950s as sort of almost like an Eden for like a Edenic paradise for the United States. But I think we're going past even that now, and if you go past that, you find yourself in the 1940s. And in the 1940s, that means the war, and that means the Holocaust. And that's where we are, but not just as a cultural matter. That's actually where we fucking are right now. We are dealing with the paranoia of starting another world war. And we are dealing with how many times does the Holocaust get mentioned in the news every day? Way more than anyone should ever have been comfortable with. How many times are we hearing about genocide and revisiting the history of 1948 and like all this stuff? Like we're talking about it all the time now. And I think that if you think about this search back as us trying to find the point at which we had choices to make and we want to go back in time and make the right choices, I kind of think like right now we have that opportunity. Like the United States right now is being seen around the world as like the world is much the way it is right now, largely because of what of our choices. And if we deny that, then it means that we deny that we have any, like we deny our pole position as the leader of the world. So we kind of have to accept that responsibility. And the world sees us in that position. And it says, look, the things that are happening are it's incumbent on the decisions you're making. So we have the decision-making power. We're at that spot in our past again where we have to make big choices and we got to make the right ones. And it's scary, Jess, because, John, I think we're not up to it. I am feeling that we embarked on this search of our past to get to the point where we are like, okay, this is where we need to go back to correct the decisions that we made. And we're there now, and we're making even fucking worse decisions. We should have never gone back. But here we are.
Yeah, because we're kind of doing like societally what we think AI is doing, right? We're just ingesting all of it, the assumption that it was good and wherever we were at is good, and then just rolling the ball from there.
We assume that if we got confronted with genocide, we would make the right choice. We become enablers of it. We thought that if we get back to the point where we're starting
there's
to
no
talk about...
There's no guardrail anymore. You thought that was the ultimate guardrail. You thought that was the ultimate taboo. Nope.
We are relying right on Iran to keep a lid on fucking World War III.
Yeah.
Okay? Like, we thought that if we got back to great power conflict, that we would make the right choices again. We're pushing for World War III. No one at all is even talking about calming down.
This return to World War II thing is really interesting because there was, of course, we're living in a kind of an ideological refounding in the wake of an ideological refounding of the U.S. after that war. A lot of the, sort of the self-understanding of the country, let alone its, you know, the terms of reference, right? The reference points of it, of the political class and of foreign policy is World War II. They can't get beyond right. it. You're always, or the build up to it. You're always at Munich and Chamberlain and so on, and it's always World War II. It's like a refounding of the country, just as
because
the Civil
we know
War
that
was
that
refounding.
Was the beginning of our empire,
of where
that
we
was
are,
the beginning
yeah.
of
yeah.
what we are.
Yeah. Something yeah. fundamentally changed, changed after the war. The U.S. Yeah. is not the same country it was. Before that, it's a vastly extended, expanded empire. And it's, well, in those terms, I think it's exactly right that they're going back to it. I'm not seeing it. I'm not quite sure what you're talking about in terms of, you know, the liberal elite, but it would make sense.
What I'm saying is...
Yeah, no longer... Yeah, sorry, go on.
Sorry, what I'm saying is not that we are recreating 1940s culture. What I'm saying is that this search for, you know, this cultural search for something in our past where everything was right and we could have, you know, the Eden, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The Eden
yeah.
of the empire. If we had made the right decisions at that time, we wouldn't have gotten stuck in the present fucked up-ness, right? That's everyone in America knows that things went wrong,
right?
Right? Yeah. So we want to go back. We want to trace our way back and then make the right decision. No, so that we can have our future back.
You know, it's really funny you brought this up.
Once again, faced with an axis. You're back to the talk of an axis.
People, this is how people act. Like, think about it. As an individual, it's not hard to understand as an individual, right? You made a bad choice somewhere down the road. Like, your life is a mess right now. You have all, you know, everything's going wrong. Your friends are leaving you. Your marriage is broken. You know, all sorts of terrible things. You lost your, you know, everything's going wrong. So what do? You look back to see where did I go wrong, and then
so
you
see
wish.
Liberals doing this. You see the kind of left liberals also.
Yes, of course. I think the whole country right now is absolutely not a single goddamn person is convinced by Joe Biden's reelection campaign that everything's great. No, not a single person believes that. I don't think a single person in the United States actually believes that. Hmm. I think everyone knows we something went wrong sometime. And like all people who find themselves in a really bad position, you fantasize about going back in time and changing things and fixing things. And that's what we're doing at a cultural level. We're fantasizing about this. What I'm saying is we've gone all the way back to the 1950s, the Eden of the empire, right? And guess what? We actually got our wish because a lot of the unresolved issues from the immediate aftermath of World War II have come back up, right? We have to make the right choices again as if it was fucking 1946, right? All those issues are still alive.
Absolutely.
All those issues are still actively alive, and we have the opportunity now not just to go back in time and reimagine, but like in real time, these choices are presented to us now. This is not part of the cultural search. This is the real world. And all I can see us is making even worse decisions than we would have in 1946. And it's very disturbing to me. So I'm with there with Ray Dalio, ladies and gentlemen. I don't feel good about this at all.
You were more sanguine, or you were more skeptical of the possibility of civil war.
We're going to start World War III. Yeah. I think the rest
no,
of the world
about
is
the internal
war.
Conflict.
I think
you know you were thinking of a conflict. Slow burn, the kind of Dead Star scenario.
Slow burn. It could just keep going.
It could just keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
you know, people couldn't even get their shit together enough to actually. Hold us
yeah, the things that I've seen, you know, the things that we've seen collectively over the past year,
yeah,
I think is suggesting that we have our limits actually, and something's going to break. Mm. You know,
yeah, I mean, I read military reports sometimes, and it's kind of funny. They're talking the military actually seems to stand slightly against a like White House, you know, congressional policy, because they're saying, guys, we can't do a war. The army's like, we can't find recruits, guys.
That's why they want to allow non-citizens in the military.
Yeah, there is no will, there is no capability. It's just not going to happen. They said if you make them poor and desperate, they'll sign up for the army. And the army just had its worst recruitment year on record.
We're going to start a Latin American Foreign Legion. That's where we're headed next.
Yeah. So, you know, that's another dimension of factionalism, right? The elites might want a war and the people are tapped out. You'd still need bodies to fight a war, as much as they talk about the drone warfare or, you know, technology, making AI in charge of the missiles. That's still not happening. You need bodies on the ground and that shit's not happening. So what are they going to do? They're going to have to get more aggressive on the people far before they can get aggressive on anybody else. Well, so that's a hedge.
They reach for proxy war. I mean, that's the other
they
answer.
They do. So right? That's, you know,
they're quite open about it. None of our guys out there, all these Ukrainians dying, it's a great deal, right? It's Taiwan next, or it's the Philippines being thrown into it. There's that.
Yeah.
But there are real limits to that, especially in East Asia. You start something there, it's going to have to be Americans, from the start.
I really liked your prompt, actually, because you're talking about, you know, we go, I don't know if I've mentioned this, but I started a project recently, again, like software development, just a thing that I had in my mind for a little while, just never got around to starting it. I finally decided, okay, fine, screw it. This is the year. I'm just going to start it. And then the experiment that I've been kind of running, it's just me and two other people that we've been trying to do is that we're all tired. We're all you know, veterans of this bullshit tech industry. So our challenge to ourselves was, why don't we try to do this as if the era we came up in hadn't happened? So using technology, it was a giant historical deep dive for all of us, basically relearning the roots of our industry, like analyzing forks in the road that people have taken. This, of course, turns into a giant spiral. You can't read about this without economic history, economic policy, and like political history on top of that. So it was, you know, we basically went era by era backwards and then said, okay, we like this from 1964. That architecture in 1972 is fantastic and was completely lost to time by business interests, basically. 1989, the Plan 9 operating system. We want to borrow some architecture from there. We're going to ignore a lot of the bullshit from web development because that was a horrific, slow-rolling train wreck from...
horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
everything from the start of clutched, packed together, cookies, fucking bullshit.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like we're even like trying to like. There's some things that we're just constrained because if we want to put it on the web, there's just like UI things that you know you cannot get around if you just want it to be a functional site. But like even trying to think about an alternative design language, as if the sans serification, the appification of everything era had not happened. So it's been a very interesting challenge, but that was personally very validating for me because it's like to do this, I was held up on it because I was thinking if I do this, I have to use all this garbage that I hate so deeply to do this, and I'd rather not do it than have to do that. So if I have this small window of opportunity, why don't I just, as a thought experiment even, just try to pull in things from the past that I personally respect and admire and see if it can work today.
Good for you, because I do believe strongly that any creative energy and force in America right now has to come outside of the strict hierarchy of careerism. Careerism is a creativity
killer.
Mm-hmm. It is a dehumanizing thing. I can feel it because I'm a careerist. Anyone who wants to make money is a careerist, right? Mm-hmm. So we're all careerists. And it's solely about turning yourself into an input-output machine. And the main cognitive goal of a careerist is to understand what the valid inputs are and what the valid outputs are.
And what your product actually is.
Yeah.
Sometimes right. You are the product. Yes.
Well, you're an input out. You're an ingester machine. Things come in, mm-hmm. things go out. Emails come in, emails go back out. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's all you are. You're being reduced to a cell within a body. Right. And that's careerism. But without purpose, mm-hmm. any sense of larger purpose. And that's reflected in our cultural critiques about this, which is none of this careerism adds up to shit. But I don't care because that's beyond my pay grade. I'm just here for the money. So how could you possibly have any creative energy under those conditions? You can't. So I think people who are trying to bring their whole selves into their career and are trying to find creative or intellectual stimulation or gratification in their career are fucked as a rule, top to bottom. That's what I believe. And in fact, I think the closer you are to believing that you've achieved that, the worse off you are, because you're going to be totally investing your creative energies into the wrong thing. So if your starting point is I'm doing this completely outside the bounds of my own career goals, I think that's like the only way to actually kind of stretch your creative, your creative self anymore. It cannot be part of
your career.
It
brought me out of a pretty deep depression, feeling stagnant. It was a conscious effort to, okay, I am just going to refuse to look at the news aside from just the headlines. So I'm woefully behind on everything aside from the biggest of things. Shut myself off from that, because that's the thing. I have no control over it. And I hate either ingesting the news as a passive, as like infotainment, basically, or as a chemical reaction. This is just where I get my fix of adrenaline and dopamine.
It's like they're trying to make sense out of something that actually doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
They're lying to you, and you know this is a fucking fairy tale. And I'm an adult. This is beneath my dignity to listen to this shit. So I just turn it off, you know?
So I cut it off and then just started on my own personal project to just really dig deep and retrace and pick out what I like and then make a conscious and just kind of a personal fuck you to the things that I hate.
Yeah.
And we talked about this, the problems of the white collar class. So Teen, I 110% agree with you. Not a single goddamn person in America thinks this is going right. How do I know this fact? Yeah. The architects, the people, the henchmen who have to go in every day to keep the system running are the ones who hate it the most sometimes.
Yeah,
remember
that anecdote I told you about a senior US official, and you got that spot on, right? They're careerists.
They're careerists. Mm-hmm. Here's someone needs, in the future field of American watching studies. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Someone's going to have to lay down the basic principles of what American late stage or whatever the fuck you want to call it, careerism is. And I think I've identified at least one principle, which is careerists want to please everyone. Mm-hmm. Because all they care about is keeping their job and moving up. That's all they care about. And so you have to please everyone. Any negative opinion of you, hurts your review process, hurts your chances. And so you're trying to be, you, this is why liberals, and careerism is largely a liberal space, are always both sidesing everything and never stand for anything. Because there's a, they're afraid, they're deathly afraid of pissing anybody off. Which ends up, I think, fucking the whole system collapses under that situation because you're not making any choices. You're not.
Hey, what's the word that we? I feel like this is a kind of a an interesting thing that happened. What's one of the worst things you can call someone these days? Performative, a performance of human emotion, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is kind of a white collar code language. I feel like we lob that at each other because that's actually fundamentally one of our biggest anxieties.
Yeah, it hurts to be seen it hurts as a because fraud. I am performative.
Yeah, because it's all performance. We know this. We perform morning to night. We perform at work. We perform for. I mean, we fucking appified marriage for fuck's sake. You're a commodity that can get swiped left or right. We're volunteering to be meat in a meat market. You are the product. You are performing. You're performing for a partner. You're performing to have the chance at fucking love, a family relationship. You're performing for your boss. You got dragged in. You're now economically constrained because the system hijacked the best intentions of young people and chained them to a system that's going to punish you for it.
Yeah, I mean, I really feel sorry for young people. I do. I guess I'm a vet. Like, I view the whole system as a giant system of incarceration. That's basically what it is. And, you know, it is also prison is like the last level of it, obviously, right? But like, it's a system where your freedom is constrained by the payment of money. Like, to actually enlarge your freedom, right? You got to pay. And I really feel like I'm a vet in this system, you know, like you got a certain sentence and the sentence is having enough money so that you don't have to work anymore. Right. That's your way out of incarceration level 5 or whatever the fuck. Right. And I feel like I'm a veteran in this system. And like the new people that are coming in, I'm like, they don't even know. Oh, well, for a while, they didn't even know that was a system. But finally, like the new kids that are showing up in cell block D that we live in, they know. They fucking know. They're like going off in the corner with their TikTok and they're like, this whole thing is stacked against me. Like, what is this shit? I'm never going to get out of here. And I'm like, yep, welcome to class. Welcome to cell block D, you know? Yeah. And I feel bad because I'm like, you know, I've been at this for a while and I had the bliss of ignorance and, you know, whatever. And I'm kind of getting close to the end of my sentence, guys, you know, like I'm out of here soon. But like, the new kids are coming in. I'm like, guys, you're looking at a lifetime of toil and they know it. And it hurts because it's like, there's no way out. You know what I mean? There's no way out. And they're not psychologically prepared for that. And that's why they're breaking down and they're looking for ways out. They're all of their culture. All of the youth culture in the United States is about finding a way to hack them to escape. It's all about escape. To get out of the fucking prison, you know, that's the culture right now. That's, I mean, if you see American culture that way, it makes a lot more sense. Otherwise, if you don't see it that way, I found you're reduced to trying to advance stupid culture war arguments about how people really should be. It's like, oh, the problem is your attitude. The problem is how you see things. No, the problem is reality. And all, you know, your cultural arguments, you can have them all you want, but the base reality is you are not free. You are facing a lifetime of toil and there's no way out. And your creativity gone, your passions out, other, you know, your social bonds, the primacy of family, primacy of friends, you having leisure time, you having being valued as a creative person gone out. You're a consumer and you're a worker. Shut the fuck up. And you have until however long it takes for you to have enough money so that you can stop working and die at zero. That's like so bleak, but that is literally the system. And kids are not having it anymore. They're not, fuck it. I'm not doing it.
Yeah, more.
I'm not doing it. I'll do anything not to be in that, including living in my car. Fuck you.
You know? It's, we see that in the numbers. More and more people are just fucking dropping out.
Dropping out. So you know what? When people start talking about, ooh, is the U.S. going to start a world war? I'm like, dude, we don't have the fucking manpower to do it. We can't even get people to work in the Starbucks. You think they're going to go on a ship and try and kill and shoot at Russians? Fuck that.
You know, at this point, it's even odds. A lot of us would just fucking cross the line and fight for the Russians.
Yeah.
But we're dying for king and country.
On the other side. I like their chances better.
Yeah.
Oh, come on.
Like, yeah. Pick a war with China. I'm selling out immediately. I know which side is better food. All right.
Did you see?
I'm not going to be first over that
TikTok
hill,
guys.
Man.
The TikTok guys are like, "What's wrong with TikTok? I want to know what the Americans are doing."
That's
China can have my data. I don't care about the Chinese.
Yeah, that's why the content of it is also intolerable to the ruling class.
You know,
it's not just how effective TikTok is commercially, but who's using it and what they're saying on it, right?
I can't help but
feel for the kids. For example, on the university campuses, you know, we went to visit some of them and just getting beaten up over an issue which is ground level humanity, about their humanity.
They're being abused. Yeah. If they're up for some complicated
ideological project, right? Yeah. So many of them are out there for a very clear moral purpose.
Yeah, because they're human beings.
And they're human beings. They don't want to see children being slaughtered.
Yeah.
And you go beat them up. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge...
We call them spoiled shits.
Can you imagine how they feel? Because I could see it in the eyes of some kids, right? At the new school, the day after they were kind of beaten up. It was shell shock.
Shell shock.
And it's total moral abandonment by their elders, right? I still see kids as kids. I'm Chinese. I'm an older guy, right? I would see them as our children. Do you do this to your kids? Whose children are these? They're somebody's children.
Well,
right? They are America's children.
There's an intermediate position here too, right, John? Which is that we could have bought them off, which is, okay, my child doesn't like this. Our children don't like seeing this. But, you know, what if we distracted them with some treats? Which Joe Biden has tried to do with the, you know, forgiving debt and legalizing marijuana and stuff like that, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Get them high and give them some money. Maybe they'll shut the fuck up.
Yeah,
right?
Let's legalize cannabis. Right. Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, honestly, the kids are onto that too. They're like, dude, you think forgiving $15,000 means shit to me? Do you know how much a house fucking costs? The amounts of money that we're trying to bribe these kids with is not enough. Okay.
Yeah.
Like the whole economic.
Yeah. Not when the cost of college is $85,000 a year.
Yeah. Now, like if it was the 1990s or the whatever or some other period in recent past where if you worked hard, you could work for a company and then come out and you'd be a millionaire by 30. Okay. Maybe the kids will be distracted enough to just spend all their time coding or whatever the fuck. But that doesn't work when Google and Facebook and everyone's laying people off, right? The number of seats is shrinking, and the kids know this. They fucking know this. Kids are really smart about this stuff. They know that their future prospects look like shit, and so
these
we can't
kids
buy them
are
off.
In some ways, you know, they've been compared to kids in the Columbia kids to, you know, people 50 years ago, their predecessors 50 years ago. But that generation had cheap or free college.
Yep.
They had
prospects.
They didn't have the debt and the financial fear hanging over them that this generation of kids has. You know, one of the kids told me, look, if I'm suspended, right, that's the end of my financial aid. So then he's landed with the full bill, right? They know that. They're much more vulnerable. And the thing they're fighting for is, you know, they don't even have skin in it in the sense that they, to the extent that, well, they were going to be conscripted. No. They're just standing up for this, and you go in there and beat them up. Really, yeah. I mean, you kettle them and beat them up. That was the thing, and arrest them. Wow, the message you're sending to them,
yeah,
it's chilling.
And it, you know what? I think that the larger dynamic that's going on there is that it's not really about Gaza. It is about Gaza.
Yeah.
But what's more in terms of us, right? In terms of us Americans, the Gaza thing was the Gaza protests is a it was a test to see for these kids to see like, wait, is there any humanity left in our system, in our elders that are telling us what to do and forcing us into debt and forcing us to work in these companies that we don't really want to work in, doing things we don't really want to do. Yeah. Is it for a good cause? And do they have any humanity worth me sacrificing my life for? That's what it's about. And what they're seeing clearly is no, there is no humanity left in them. It's just raw compliance. And if you don't comply, we're going to fuck your life up.
Yeah.
And you know what? I think a lot of kids are like, well, then I'm just going to go live in a car and say, fuck you. Or I'm going to leave the United States. Or, you know, I'm going to completely, you know what? We're just going to burn everything down and, you know, whatever. Whatever it is. Anything but working for you motherfuckers. They're running away from home.
Yeah.
And more power to them. They should run away. They should run away.
Yeah. I think my my era, like the right before, like on the heels of the 2008 financial crisis, that was the last real like distinct period when that tactic could work.
Yeah,
because
I got bought
like
off.
Yeah, I got bought off too. I remember like Palestine, like free Tibet, free Palestine. You know, not that those two are equivalent, but you know, those were like the two canonical like university campus protest movements, right? They were there, but I just walked by them. I go to my DOD funded class on ballistics, and then the idea is like, and then you kind of you do volunteer work in the community as like moral carbon credits or something. Basically, the idea is that you embed. That kind of is what it is. Like you spend the day learning how to the mechanics of bombing shit or building things that can destroy shit. And then an entire January was funded by an oil Chevron. It was like across all departments, and our 4 week long, like whole of campus endeavor was figuring out how to make drilling beneath the oil table at that point in 2007 profitable. Because we thought that we were hitting the limits of the oil fields at our disposal at the time. So the idea, but below a certain depth, it takes more than a gallon of gasoline to get a gallon of gasoline out. So the profit just isn't there. How to maximize that profit. And then we do that during the day. And then at night we go and volunteer in the community. Anyway, so you just walk by that. The idea is that embedding yourself in this system that does all this still has a personal benefit to me and and people I care about, and that also there's a possibility for change. Obama got elected on this shit. Yes. He was the hope and change candidate. He literally ran on this. So that's the last distinct era when the lie had any shred of credibility.
He now ran on it now and used it up and completely exposed it.
Well, we still, because we had zero interest rates. Mm-hmm. We had frictionless capitalism. I think frictionless capitalism worked. It's like, when you're at the apex of your ballistic trajectory and for a moment you're just hanging in the air.
Yeah.
And it's just, every force is like in equilibrium.
That was,
and you're just hanging there, you're levitating. But it doesn't last.
That's the last 2 years of Clinton. That's the last 2 years of the Clinton presidency.
Well, I think Obama brought a little of that magic back with the zero interest rates, right? And
that's fucking marketing. That's the marketing.
No, it's not. It's not. It had real financial effects. And it was an afterburner effect. It was just like, let's have a final fucking cash orgy. Just blow this motherfucker out. And that's what he did.
You're correct. I'm saying from my perspective, the perspective of the beleaguered consumer and a hapless citizen of this fucking mess, that was a smokescreen to hide coming.
It was a total smokescreen. It was a very, I would say, cynical thing to do. Again, and it's totally part of the logic of America, which is whatever it takes to get to November, right? Like, I'm not jeopardizing my grasp on not just power, right? Here's the thing. Obama wasn't interested in power. Obama was more than happy. Obama's a fucking influencer, okay? Obama is more than happy to be in a photo literally where Richard Branson is choking him on his own boat. That he was like, "Hey, I'm palling around with Richard Branson." I'm like, "Richard Branson is a fucking 2-bit billionaire. You were the president of the United States. This is beneath your dignity, sir. Why are you on a jet ski with this motherfucker and this guy's choking you? I know you're playing around, not stupid, but that's not that, like, sorry, those are not good optics for you."
It's a cultural moment, yeah.
Yeah, right? Obama showing up and just being bitch slapped by everyone left. He didn't care about power. He was no LBJ, right? He was not someone that understood how to wield power or whatever. He was an influencer. He wanted to get famous. He wanted to be loved.
He wanted to be in bed with the powerful. So he's the bezel. You know about, like, you've probably seen, you know, descriptions of the bezel. Like, you know what the bezel is, right?
On a screen? John?
Oh, no, B-E-Z-Z-L-E. So this is talking about the con man's act.
Never heard of it.
The bezel is that moment right after the trick is pulled. It's a very liminal moment when right after the card trick or magic trick, the rabbit disappears. And then the cape is dramatically revealed to show that there's no rabbit inside the hat. That moment is called the bezel. The performer knows that the move has been successful. The audience is still caught in the magic before any possibility of thought has had the chance to creep in. And you process that like, oh, that was the magic trick. Or how did that happen? This is just like, whoa, the rabbit disappeared. That moment is called the bezel. The Obama presidency is the fucking bezel. He's dazzled all of us, sold out what he was tasked with managing, and then bounced.
Yeah, and then left Joe Biden on the stage.
Joe Biden
is the guy that just, like, you know, he just tries to get your attention however way as everyone runs out the back of the fucking door, man. I mean,
yeah,
just like, he is so disgraceful, like, just so. He's just so, I cannot believe that we, like, grown people are trying to tell us that we should be proud of this man that to be our president.
Yeah.
Like how much do you pay people? Like, in fact, I don't even think they're getting paid. I mean, I really think that they're just literally out of options. And they're like, okay, it's him or it. Literally, this is the politics of the liberals. Okay. Yeah. I mean, sure, he sucks, but the other option is that fucking guy. Like that's the world that they're trying to sell us on now. You think you're going to get kids to buy in to kill themselves for the country? You think you're going to get kids to fight line up for a war? It's a joke. It's a fucking joke.
It's not
joke.
Even the kids. Fucking me. Like, a couple of weeks ago, there was this joke floating around out there. It's, I guess, like The Onion or, you know, the Babylon Bee or something. And the headline was just like, China cracks down on big tech's, quote, bloated websites, imposing new JavaScript limits. I thought that was funny. It was posted in our Patreon Discord, and I took it and I showed it to a bunch of people I knew. Like, half of them were like, took it literally, and they're like, oh my god, I need to get a job in China. Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah. You think there's loyalty? And they see the ASPI being like, no, we need to ban our engineers from collaborating with the Chinese. Like, we need to cut open source. We need to stop allowing the Chinese and the Americans and the Europeans to play together in open source development. Fuck you. Fuck you. That's the very fucking day I signed up for an account on China's version of GitHub.
The question now, though, is what we Americans understand this because we're living it. But what does the rest of the world see? I don't think they see this. I don't think they understand
this. We have a very oiled propaganda machine, and reputation is very... inertia, like historical memory, is a very hard thing to disrupt.
Well, yeah, there's huge inertia. I still think
there's
it comes
inertia, right?
Inertia, but you know what?
Many of the changes you're talking about actually happen, as you said, Tien. It's very volatile, and the descent, while it has long a kind of, you know, long set of causes, it's been a long time coming. But in the last few years, it's been really precipitous. And people just haven't caught up in their heads with what's going on.
Yeah, it's like what was a cold became kind of pneumonia. What was pneumonia? It's now something pretty
really
fucking bad,
rolling.
You know?
Yeah.
Fine. Yeah, and but I'll say, I mean, I think the U.S., my view right now of what our economy is like, just kind of thinking through like what's really going on. You know, it is an economy that is almost entirely driven by monetary privilege. It's almost entirely driven by our ability to control and basically create money that is used around. I mean, it's as if we had a golden goose back in the day of the gold standard. It's literally how our economy works now. The government, you know, our economic growth is meager. It is and all of that is entirely reliant on the largest, you know, fiscal, party you've ever seen, fiscal and monetary, just blowing out everything, all limits gone in terms of what we're willing to print and spend. And the economy is barely growing because of that. It is keeping people employed. It is preventing a massive recessionary crash, which we desperately need, right? We desperately need to relieve the asset inflation and get people's lives back on track. But we won't do it because we also know that that would crater the one really thing that we got going in our economy now, which is the ability to control the money supply of the world, right? And that ability, I think, still is, you know, that is the ring of power. Like, that's the one ring to rule them all, is the dollar. And, you know, I think that a lot of it's cultural inertia, it's soft power, it's this. But it's also the fact that you got to do all your trade in U.S. dollars. You've really got to think about your balance sheet in terms of U.S. dollars. Your national balance sheet in terms of U.S. dollars. And so long as that's the case, you just can't dismiss the Americans.
Yep.
You know? And so I think the Americans are, you know, we're living on the dollar right now. We're not living on our economy or our productivity or anything. We're living on the dollar. And that's not going to last. You know, that's not going to last.
Yeah. So it's a virtualized economy. So basically,
it's a golden goose economy. It's really dangerous.
And we're all feeling at some level how fake and unstable and precarious and fundamentally unhuman.
You're still telling lies about how inflation's under control. It's going to go back to 2%. Are you fucking kidding me? If you were to do the actual thing that you need to do, which is constrain the money supply, the economy would immediately crash. So as long as the economy's not crashing and we're going to have high inflation, which they're lying about. It's much higher than the 3.8 or whatever. Everyone who buys things in America knows it, right? They're lying about that. We're living on the dollar. Plain and simple, you know? So how long is that going to be able to last? I don't know. But, I mean, they're working their asses off just to get through the next month, right? I mean, look at the way, like, 10-year rates blow out the second, you know, Jerome Powell says anything. Everyone's nervous, you know? They're rightfully nervous. So,
yeah, it's a virtualized economy, a virtualized political culture. It's sort of the dollarification of everything.
Yeah. And we're doing everything we can.
Engineering,
finance. We're going to seize those Russian assets.
Yeah.
Right? We're telling them. I don't know what we're doing, but it's like we're living on the dollar and we're telling everyone to get off the dollar. What?
We've been talking about the engineering, moral, you know.
You know,
philosophical and political consequences of free money.
You know who called us out?
I love Jess's phrase. It's still ringing in my head, you know, sort of the 2-year pump and dump cycle on a societal scale.
Yikes. You know?
That's a hell of a phrase.
But you know who called us out on this shit was China. China called us out on this after the GFC and said this event points to the fundamental paradox of being the world reserve currency issuer. You will run into problems called the Triffin dilemma.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not okay. It's the oldest parable, like with great, when you come into the power of printing the dollar for the world, you know, there's going to be downsides to that. It's not just like, oh yeah, hey, we're going to live like fucking kings forever. That's not what this is. And you know, 2008, China, I think there was an economist at the PBOC that released the paper that said Triffin's dilemma was real, meaning when you're the reserve currency of the world, you have to make decisions based on your domestic policy needs in terms of monetary policy, and you have to also make decisions on the foreign policy side of things, also based on money, but they're going to be pointing in different directions.
Yeah.
Right. One side's going to want to keep the value up. One side needs the value to drop. And you're not going to be able to have it both ways. And what we're seeing now is, I think our foreign policy is taking precedence over our domestic policy. We would rather support the Israelis than support our own people. You know, we would rather contain China than develop our own economy. You know, all this stuff. Okay, fine. Whatever. You choose whatever side you choose. The issue ultimately is that you came into this power and you're not going to be able to have it both ways. But we would rather maintain the empire than to have, like, you know, to build a proper functioning.
You know, it's commonly said, it's often said, right? Foreign policy is domestic policy. But actually, now you have domestic policy is foreign policy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Empire come home in a big way and you're ruling the sort of domestic situation with actually foreign policy priorities.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's one currency to rule them all, man. You know, it's all fucked up. We're living it here in America. So yeah, look at you. Look at him with that smug laugh. It feels different over here.
We're talking. He's visiting us and we're talking to him with the little prison telephone through the glass.
Yeah. Oh, I got to put another quarter in this guy. Hold on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where they overcharge you. Right?
Yeah. No. Oh, shit.
It's awful. The whole prison thing is just so much more than a metaphor.
I mean, it's adding another pebble onto this mountain of this mountain we're building here. This guy I keep seeing on LinkedIn, I blocked him and everything, but it keeps popping in like some kind of zombie. It's the billionaire who made his money on prison communications. It took some time to dig him up, too. This is a billionaire, a fucking billionaire, who made his money charging $5 a minute to the most vulnerable, locked up people in America.
Yeah.
And he's on LinkedIn being a thought leader.
Freedom ain't free, Jess. Freedom ain't free.
Fuck.
Perfect. That's my favorite line of all time. It's so fucking perfectly Orwellian. And everyone believes it.
Now
ain't free, buddy.
Now they're giving them tablets. Free. You know, it's perfect, right? You just crush everything. You give them the tablet. Now they're giving them tablets.
Yep. Yeah.
Kind of horrific kind of devices where they have to pay for the thing to work.
Are the billionaire who made his money off prisoners wanting to talk to their families. That's who we promote.
I have a theory. There's two types of Americans that you can trust to be objective and truthful about the system, right? One are the vets it's the people that already their sentence is almost up or already up, meaning they have financial freedom, right? Yeah. The other are the new kids, the ones that are just getting in here and they're like, what the fuck is this? That's it.
Yeah.
People who are sort of in the middle of their sentence are so deep into the shit.
Yeah, they have to pay the.
They have to maintain
putting the coins into the machine.
They're like, don't tell me about how the system's fucked. I know it's fucked, but don't remind me, because what are my fucking options, guy? I got two kids, I got three kids, I got mortgage, I got, you know, like, what are you going to tell me? I can't get out of here, you know. So, the people who are most right now, I think, ideologically committed, are the people who have a lot of debt. And a lot to lose.
That's why they call it debt peonage. It's not an exaggeration. It's not hyperbole. That is what it's designed to do. Yes. This is the system working as designed.
The silent oppressor in America is debt.
Mm-hmm.
It's the silent oppressor. We don't talk about it. We measure it. We charge the fuck out of it in terms of interest. We don't really talk about it that much in terms of, you know, how hard it is for people to manage all that debt just to have a home, you know, like and by debt, I specifically mean mortgages, but also credit card debt, also auto loans, also, you know, obviously education loans, all that shit. It adds up, and it adds up it to a sentence. You're not free. Even after you pay that off, you're just back at zero. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you're just back at zero. You don't, you're not suddenly like free. You just got to build up an excess after that, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, okay, during asset inflation, I guess it gives people a think, you know, they believe that if I pay off my debt, the asset inflation will get me to where I need to go, just sort of, but that's over. So
there's a massive pressure here and kind of a societal inability, right, to clear debt, to forgive debt, which always builds up in every society. And this is civilization ending stuff. If you can't have some means of clearing up the debt. This is as
and look, the debt, as, and that's a very hard wall to hit, and no one has ever scaled. You either clear the debt or it is cleared for you. One way or the other, the debt ends. It fucking ends. Yeah. Like one way to look at
you
the French Revolution.
It will clear you. Yeah. Yep.
Absolutely. Or in one way, shape, or another, it builds up bad enough. The music stops right there. Like there's an analysis of the French Revolution in terms of debt. Like we can talk fancy about all political philosophy, high-minded ideology, the rights of man, the rights of freedom, the building of a nation, all of that. You can also say that that was after 15 years of terrible harvests and debt had accrued to very unsustainable levels, and that's when people snapped.
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting is that in the U.S., you know, most of the debt that we're talking about is secured, right? So you have mortgages, a secured debt. If you default on the debt, your house is collateral for that debt. If it's an auto loan, same thing. The car is collateral for the auto loan debt, right? Education, you can't really take away. I can't really secure my debt with my fucking, you know, degree, right? Like, what am I going to do? Put my fucking law degree up as collateral for my law student, for my law school debt?
Repo your brain?
Yeah, you're going to repo my diploma? It doesn't work, right? The diploma has no value. You can't.
Wasn't it Biden who led the move to make this debt not forgivable?
Undissolvable?
Not dissolvable?
Yes, in the 1990s.
Yes, yeah. So exactly. So the second you're dealing with unsecured debt, meaning they can't really take anything away from you if you default on it, they suddenly make it an exception to the bankruptcy rule. So you cannot discharge education loans through bankruptcy. So, I mean, that move right there showed you this is about debt peonage, exactly what Jess is saying. This is about disciplining the population through debt, because the second we're talking about uncollateralized debt, can't discharge it through it's lifetime debt. And that's pretty scary. That was a pretty scary moment when we saw that happen. A debt that follows you around forever cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. Right? That's the system we're living in.
Have given them the incentive. In fact, the requirement, right, for their freedom to take the whole system down.
Yep.
It's the only way they're going to get out of it.
They're just raising the stakes and they're just like...
You're kettling and beating up and arresting, right? And zip tying, okay?
By an old, corrupted,
deeply
perverted, ruling class that is in their 80s now and won't give it up. So...
You see how we went from technology debt to this...
To real
it's
fucking
debt all the way down.
It's debt all the way
down. If you just need a snapshot on America, that's it's very high level, but it's done in 15 minutes. Teen, that's the one that I sent you. Scott Galloway's TED Talk.
He's good on that topic. I've got other issues with that guy, but he's good on the issue of how we
treat very our kids. High level. Yeah. But like in a snapshot, that's where we're at. So if that's that's what America is right now. Whatever the propagandists say is their business, but that's an encapsulation of what we are. So, John, I don't know if you want to. I think it's easy to find. It's got like millions of views. It's on the official TED Talk channel on YouTube. Yeah.
Also, I'll be looking for that book on the French Revolution. But
Call me about Scott Galloway, though. I think the problem with Scott Galloway is he's still preaching. No matter what he says, he's still preaching. You know, the the entrepreneurial way out, you know, like
He runs a podcast with Kara Swisher, who is one of my most hated tech journalists, an apologist for the worst reptiles that have crawled out of the swamp in the last 15 years.
I actually detest Scott Galloway.
I'm not a big fan of him.
I think a lot of people right now. There's a lot of people now who are able to sort of identify some of the symptoms of the problem correctly, mm-hmm. and are honest about that. Good. But then their assessment of the root cause and thus their recommendations on what to do to fix that, it's all based on just sort of like a lot of internal searching and say, what did I do to become this successful guy? He's worth nine digits, right?
Scott Galloway, not the NYU prof, right? Not that.
He is an NYU prof, but he was an entrepreneur before.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I saw another talk where he talked about last year.
I mean,
that guy's a fucking asshole.
Yes.
Yeah. But he is good. I will say, he is good at diagnosing and being sympathetic to the problems of young people in terms of, you know, how we just dismiss them. But he's a fucking asshole. He knows he's a fucking asshole. He thinks he's a reformed asshole, but he's not. But
right.
If it's notable, it's like more and more, like occasionally I'll be like, wow, Tucker Carlson, I'm just nodding along. So it's a data point to just see people who would be otherwise ideologically opposed.
No longer they can like, deny. They're like, look, I can't deny what's going on.
We're all seeing it.
Yeah.
So that's a strong data point towards something.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as for like a solution, you know, I don't like anybody who stands up there and proposes to have a solution.
There's no solution.
That's not how this is. Yeah. I mean, it goes to
the solution is for everything to fall apart.
Yeah.
You got to hit like rock bottom. Sorry.
Absolutely.
I've thought about this a lot and I've come to the conclusion that the only way through this is just through accelerationist, you know.
Oh, I firmly think so. There's a video about Byung-Chul Han actually. And then I like it. He like
Holy shit.
The earnest interviewer keeps just pushing him like, okay, so you're like really hitting all the notes. These are some bars you're putting out there, man. I get it. And you're right. So what's the solution? And he just kind of like chuckles and looks at him like he's stupid. He's like,
wait a second.
What the fuck? Yeah. I don't have a fucking solution. There is no solution to any of this. I'm just telling you how it is. There's no solution. Just eventually there will be salvation, maybe.
Yeah. Like, let's not pretend. That's the thing. I just don't think that we're going to be able to, like, you know, rediscover our roots and re-implement this Edenic version of the American Empire. Sorry, it's got to fall apart.
Yeah. And you can't go on some Marvel MCU universe shit, you know, that basically is
just
premised.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It's premised
adjust.
On people going against human nature.
Yeah,
motherfuckers.
It won't allow just, and it won't.
Look, the reason the United States was able to have such a long period of unchallenged dominance is because the world sort of entrusted us with that. A lot of times we think like we just went out and just by pure merit and dominance. No, the world believed in us, right? Post-war. This is why we have financial hegemony, is because the world decided to go with the U.S. as the world's banker, basically, right? If we have the opportunity to remake post-war level decisions about that is going to greatly affect the way the world views and whether they trust us, like, if we're going to fuck those decisions up, we don't have a goddamn chance of fixing this. So let's not, you know, all this shit about let's go back to 1950s. We had moral credibility in the 1950s. The world looked up to us. If you're going to back Israel on this shit right now, I don't care how you really personally feel about Israel. That doesn't matter. You just look at world opinion. Okay. We're the only one fucking veto in the UN. Even the UK is not following us anymore. You think that we're going to get it back? And the Scott Galloways of the world running around saying, you know, that young people need to be more financially responsible or whatever. It's like, that ain't even close to the problem, dude. It's not even close to the problem, you know? So, you know, I just don't like this personal responsibility thing that's being pushed out right now, because it's just like, it's not this, the problem is not at a personal level. You know, we have personal problems caused by the, you know, the lies that are being told to us. Sure. But the personal, it's not personal matters that created these lies. So anyway, sorry, I get very ranty about this shit. Sorry.
It's bad.
It's just, it's abuse. It's just straight up fucking abuse. And for what? No discernible reason. You know, there's no discernible reason for any of it. It's pointless. It's just, it's career. I think what it is, it's a careerist mentality that perpetuates this, because, you know, it's a fuck you got mine mentality. That's careerism. It's like, it's all just all about my career arc, you know, my arc through the institution. I don't care about the larger goals. I don't care about the larger. It's just, did I, you know, hey, did I get a nice photo op with the CEO? You know, John, for example, like in Washington, D.C., when I was working down there, you know what a big deal was? A big deal was Mary Jo White. You know, Mary Jo White came. She was the new chairwoman of the SEC, one of just a rotating number of lawyers and bankers and shit that would come in and out. Okay. So she was a lawyer that came in. She had a big meeting, a town hall to welcome herself to the staff. And the first thing she goes into is a personal anecdote about how a SEAL team invaded a cave, killed a bunch of terrorists, found an Al-Qaeda hit list. And on that Al-Qaeda hit list, her name was on it. You know what that story tells you? I matter. I'm part of the big, I'm a big cheese. Those terrorists want to kill me. You know what that means? I'm a big deal. That's in the loop. That's careerism. You know, did she care about the financial stability of, did she care about markets? Did she care about, no, this is about, I was on a kill list. That means I'm a big deal. It's the vanity of careerism is just rampant, you know, because when the system has no other value, those are only those kind of careerist narcissists are going to advance, because anyone who thinks or pledges themselves to a higher cause, well, there is no higher cause. Those people don't exist. You know what I mean? Any such people with those beliefs, Jess, I believe they have to do it outside of the careerist matrix, which is why any journalist these days that's worth their salt and is actually trying to tell the truth has to do it independent. They cannot do it as part of a job. Mm-hmm. It has to be on their own. They have to have already achieved financial independence, or they are monks and literally just have no need for money and will live a life of, you know, of poverty
and chastity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, man, that's the calculus in America right now. I'm sorry. That's just how it works.
Yeah. To do that.
Did you see Bill Burr take down Bill Maher recently?
That was wonderful.
Bill Burr is what a independent man looks like. Yeah. Okay. You got to watch it. Bill Burr goes on Bill Maher's TV show/podcast and just exerts a kind of quiet dominance over Bill Maher, who is by comparison, you know, sort of nervous.
Oh, really? And good.
You know, and Bill Maher is just sitting
manic,
there with a cigar.
It's really just asking for it.
You know, just pushing him around. And that's the difference between a guy who's famous because he's a careerist and has a job at HBO versus a guy who's rich off Patreon and shit like that and sells out shows wherever, you know, he goes to a comedy club, sells out shows, get 60% of the tickets sales or whatever it is. And he makes money on his own dime. He's not part of of an employment relationship. That's the guy who can actually be truthful and honest versus a guy who's got to nervously toe the line and make sure that his bosses don't get mad at him.
You know, if you have the entire Western leadership, you know, your 30 plus countries of NATO and so on run by these people, goes a long way towards explaining something that is a cause of puzzlement and should be a cause of puzzlement. And we need to ask why. How are these people so stupid? Not just collectively, but individually. How do they get things so wrong? Produce policy that is so deluded.
Because you have to ask yourself, at what level is it wrong? At what level is it wrong? And then ask yourself whether the decision making is taking place at that level, because it's not. So I don't know if it's necessarily because the people are stupid. It's because that they're making this, their concerns and their decision making is taking place at a careerist level, meaning I'm just here for my own career. Guys, I'm representing myself, not the United States. Okay.
Yeah.
There is no United States.
There is no higher cause.
Exactly.
People to do the right thing. I notice this everywhere. To do what we would consider, quote, the right thing amounts to a religious calling now. That's how hard it is. That's how impossible it is to actually do it and actually keep a roof over your head, keep your children fed, all of that.
I think the only exception to this, Jess, is a very dynamic company that is, you know, actually delivering something, is actually producing something and is competing. I think within a hierarchy that actually is led by leadership that understands that the thing has to work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's different. That's a different calculus. Now I think that can exist at times in companies and that the careerism of a company is a little bit different, but for an entrenched company, like a monopolist company. And I think tech has evolved into, a cartel the banking system for sure. To me, I mean, large banks in America are, in my opinion, quasi state institutions, right? They're extensions of the government for sure. I mean, there's no reason to doubt that.
They should always have been overtly state institutions.
They should overtly
Yeah, the power to create money. You're the holder of the fiat money of this privilege, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. They've always in fact, the system of like subsidy plus fines and all that stuff, and it adds up to they are slowly becoming incorporated into the state.
Yeah. It's a self-dealing, incestuous state institution, basically. That's how I see it. Have you seen the political axis chart? The four quadrants that are supposed to represent, your political affiliations?
Yeah. It's like authoritarian versus like libertarian and then conservative versus
something like that.
Whatever. Yeah, progressive.
Yeah, and then the most honest one that I saw is like, this is the actual politics of the United States. Each of the four quadrants just said, fuck banks. This is why no politician can run on this shit. They can't run on the shit that people actually give a fuck about.
So they just, like, now it's reduced to just the other person is worse than me. I mean, I honestly would rather throw in with Trump simply because Trump has a popular base, and I don't know if I like that base, but Trump has a certain power. He kind of exerts control over his own base to a way that like Biden doesn't. Like Biden can only sort of pander to what is, quote, his base, whereas I think Trump feels like he could set the agenda for them, and those people are genuinely passionate about him as a human being. Like they follow him around, like they like him. Nobody likes Joe Biden. The only people who vote for Joe Biden is they just hate Trump, you know. So I don't like Trump. I'm not passionate about the guy. I don't trust the guy, but I do think he's at least independent and not simply his whole shtick about I'm not part of the Washington thing or, whatever. It is kind of true to a limited degree. It is kind of true. And I kind of would rather throw in with him right now than with another, lifelong careerist. Mediocrity.
Well, he has followers. Biden has.
Well, I saw a headline recently. Yeah. It's, I think it was at ABC, or one of their affiliates. It's it was, we have to Trump-proof the nuclear codes for 2024.
Whatever.
Oh, wow. Okay, so the office of the president that's tasked with, nominal control over, quote, the nuclear codes. We have to make sure that the guy who legitimately if he gets legitimately elected into that office, we have to make sure that he cannot exercise the powers of that office.
They're not even serious about that. First of all, you can't do that. And second,
you can't.
It's just a scare tactic. It's stupid, I mean.
So it's just, it's all just smoke and mirrors. It's just, it's just another entertainment and outrage machine. I see no reason to connect with that. at all. I'm claiming my time back.
I think
if
with
the attention it caused me, what they wanted, you no longer have it. I don't give a shit.
Insofar as Malaysia, I mean, I hope that the leadership there still has the belief in, you know, the idea of Malaysia as a nation, as a people, that it's not just that they have a duty to them, but that they feel that that's them, you know, like they are personally invested in this.
Yeah.
Because that's, you can't find that in the United States. It's not, not part of who we are anymore. Or I don't know if it ever truly was, but it's certainly not a part of who we are now. And anyone who believes in that, I think, is like quasi fascist here in a way, because they, you know, to believe that in the United States is really largely an exercise in figuring out who to blame as to why we're not like that.
Yeah.
You know, so you become like sort of like fascist in the sense that you're trying to define an inside and an outside and blaming the outside for all your failures. And,
we go back to a point that was made earlier, actually. I think there's a lie involved or an abstraction that's just really off base. It hides more than it reveals in the kind of international relations realist assumption. These are all nation states. They all kind of behave. You can black box them. And the US is just not a nation or not a state, you know, like Japan is, for example.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, as my wife likes to say, it's not that kind of enterprise. Sometimes it's better understood as a corporation or as a project, but it's not. It's not a people the same way as some other nation is. I'm not saying anybody is a perfect example of this, but it's very, very off base, very wrong.
What's interesting about John Mearsheimer's theory of offensive realism is that the largest exception to it is his own country.
He's going around.
Yeah. What is he talking about?
He's consistently wrong about it. He's honest enough to know it, and he just doesn't seem to get to the point. He's always wrong on that particular thing.
But he kind of knows it because he's kind of like, the United States is not behaving according to my theory.
Yeah, it's not.
Right? Why are you caring so much about Ukraine? You know, in the framework of offensive realism, you shouldn't care that much.
But the whole field is based on this assumption. You almost built the field on this assumption. Your science is built out of this basic kind of theoretical entity, but it just isn't. It's exceptional in that sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's just, and offensive realism and realism in realist school in general just doesn't have. And they're upfront. We're like, we don't care about the internal politics of states. They're all the same to us. I'm like, well, the United States is different.
It's different. It is different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Anyway. That was fun, guys. We got 3.5. They'll probably give us content for a couple weeks.
We tend to
drip
do
feed
this.
These out.
Yeah.
But that was fun, guys. I gotta go.
It was fun to get this off my chest.
We should reconvene. You know, and we still have to talk about ancestors and shit.
Yeah, we do. Please, yeah, let's get to that.
Because that's big on my mind. I think
brains on. You know, I have.
Dude, the concept of ancestors.
Policy things to solve. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Go on. Ancestors. Yes.
The concept that we as people have collective ancestry is so dangerous in the United States, but it's so important to the concept of a nationality.
Yeah.
It just puts the U.S. in such a strange position. Yeah, it is so dangerous for us to believe that is matters, because
we would have to start ethnically cleansing, right? You need you need parenthood.
Yeah,
there isn't even that. Which is why I reacted quite strongly to seeing those kids. The morning after we saw those kids celebrating, right? You know, there was this really quite, as I put it, quite a joyous protest at New School the last night before they came in for them at dawn.
That,
And the following day, I saw those kids and I go, but to me, they're kids, because there is a sense, if this was China, people of that age, people in society in general would treat them as, well, these are the children of
our collective children.
Our collective children.
Yeah.
The nation's children. So this concept of ancestors, it goes right down to the basic concept of parenthood and responsibility, intergenerational sense of obligation. There wasn't that. And I saw them really quite, you know, in that sense, abandoned or without anything. All they had was this kind of moral conviction that, hey, you know,
I think our fetishization for cosmopolitanism you know, made it impossible. And I mean, and it's weird. It's not because we're evil people or whatever. That's just how we built our country. And then I think, you know, what's interesting was, you know, when Hamilton became a big thing and George Washington Alexander Hamilton was black and rapping and, you know, all this shit.
Oh, you're talking about like the musical. I thought you were talking about, oh, we're taking back to 1820.
Yeah,
oh,
no, the musical. Okay, you know, what was that? Okay. What was that? You know what that was? That was the liberal attempt to sort of be like, hey, can we all sort of view the founding fathers as our common ancestors? Mm. Like, can we just sort of like hand wave away the fact that we're just like a hyper diverse group of people without a common point of origin among us? Can we just pretend that the founding fathers are our collective, not just, you know, for the WASPs in the house, but, you know, for the black kids too, and the Hispanics and the, I think they had an Asian guy up there at some point in one of the productions played George Washington.
Sure. I mean,
can we all collectively as a nation believe that the founding fathers are all our grandpas, our great great grandpas?
Yeah.
That's what it was. It was an attempt.
Wrote better music, maybe. It was so terrible musically.
It's clumsy. Yeah, I agree. But I'm saying that ultimately they were aware of this problem.
Yes.
And this was, I believe, an attempt, clumsy as it was, but it was an attempt to say, okay, we've got to get common ancestry as like a going thing here in this country for liberalism to survive. And that's why it was such a big deal. It was such a revolutionary idea, even if it was a pretty cringy musical. But it went apeshit, and all the liberals went for it because they kind of recognized this problem of we don't have common ancestry. So can we make it up?
They can't talk about it. But they can't talk about it. You don't hear them talking about this because it's beyond the terms of liberalism. What is this thing that it's not about individuals and rights and, you know, individual rights and securing those rights and exercising them? It's just outside of their frame of reference. I mean, they all feel the need for these things that are outside the system. Suddenly, all the supporting structure that you took for granted is withered away. Right, you've got nothing left. So yeah, I agree with you guys. Things have to get a lot worse before you can start rebuilding something.
That's how I'm planning it. You know, that's how I'm setting my life up. I'm not putting a lot of stock into the ability for the United States to turn this around and dial the clock back, which is what everyone agrees needs to be done. Is we got to dial it back to a better time. There's no way forward. Everyone knows that. We can't just keep going down the same road we've been going. We got to dial it back, you know?
We're trying to make sure that we have a chair when the music stops. That's our concern.
Yeah, or that we don't need a chair because we're not in the room anymore. You know, we're like, we're off in a different room playing a different game.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
We're good. Yeah.
Great
talking to you guys. Hit you guys up more about and tap your brains.
Sure.
On industrial policy.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah.
All right.
In the face of madness.
It's mostly as a counterfactual. Just here's what we need. Here's what to not do. I don't know what to do. Yeah. Hey,
here's what not to do. Here's how not to think about what you're doing.
Yeah.
Hey, John, good luck with Malaysia.
Yeah. This is about Malaysia.
Yeah. Good luck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Malaysia's in a very sweet spot right now. So I think Malaysia stands to win a lot. They've got a strong hand, you know.
Yeah, like,
but they just don't hold the hand.
Tina and I are looking at you and Malaysia like you're the guy that escapes the asylum and he's running down the hill and all the rest of the crazies are back inside cheering because one of the good guys finally made it out. That's the dynamic here.
He was like the prison deacon. And they just brought him in on an exchange program and he was like, God damn, what the fuck is going on here?
Then he managed to get out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I feel we still have to go and deal with it. And the people I'm talking to, they have no idea. They can't process. I mean, they're nowhere near a conversation like this. We need to have it. We need to have America Watcher studies. We need to have more, you know, pods like this. I'm going to get them to listen to it. I'm going to get some of these policy guys to listen to, you know, our shit, right?
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Well, we'll have to cut it down a little bit because no one's sitting down to listen to 3.5 hours of this shit.
Yeah.
Give me the 15-minute highlight reel. You know, 10-minute.
Yeah.
Fuck it. Five
we can
minute.
Do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
Anyway. All right. Well, that was right. Plan A for this week.
Okay.
All right. See y'all.